ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For the first time in over 50 years, astronauts will soon fly around the moon.
They're ready to fly.
But there are real concerns about their safety.
We're playing Russian roulette.
In our series, The Challenger Legacy, we trace the history of two space shuttle disasters. And we ask, what are the lessons for today?
I'm Karl Kuschelnitsky.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Binge all the episodes now. Just search for The Challenger Legacy on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell joining you for Big Ideas. And today I've got a sweeping story that really gives you a sense of the shape of today's world with all its tensions and its allegiances. This is a story of shattered lands and how one colonial empire became 12 modern nation states, stretching all the way from Yemen to Myanmar.
These states were often created in very different ways, but often very haphazardly. So I think it's June 1947 that Lord Mountbatten, the Viceroy, is sent out to India to basically kind of dissolve the Raj and grant independence. He's given by Prime Minister Clement Attlee a year and a half to do it, basically, in. But he speeds it up to 77 days. And this leads to one of the craziest bureaucratic nightmares ever conceived by Kafka, where, for example, once the dust settles, it becomes clear that in the division of the libraries, all the dictionaries from A to K had gone to India, and all the kind of J to Z had ended up in Pakistan, so rushed had it been.
That and many more astonishing stories about the profound legacies of colonialism can be found in the debut book of Indian-raised Scottish filmmaker, researcher and historian Sam Dalrymple. His book has the evocative title, Shattered Lands, Five Partitions and the Making of Modern Asia. It's all about the carve-up of British India. And it was born out of Sam's work with a peace-building initiative that he co-founded called Project Dastan, which reconnects refugees displaced by the 1947 partition of India. Sam is based in Delhi, and as it happens, he's also the son of the hugely popular historian William Dalrymple, whose podcast Empire I've been enjoying of late. ABC Radio National joins Sam on stage at Ubud Writers Festival in Bali, where he's speaking with the Bangladeshi and British poet, writer and researcher Husnara Khanum.
So before we jump into questions, I just wanted to say what a wonderful book this is. And it's your first book, which is absolutely incredible. I mean, it is beautifully written. It's meticulous in its research. And what I loved about it most is the fact that you add the human element, you know? You've met with people from all over the different regions. You've even been to Bangladesh, you were telling me, and interviewed people who've actually lived through a lot of this and are still impacted by the legacy of these partitions. So, well done.
Thank you.
So we'll start off with the first question. I'd like to know, how did the idea for the book come about? What are the partitions and why does it still matter?
Sure. So the idea of this book came about whilst I was researching for Project Dastan, this peace-building initiative. The idea is that the India and Pakistan partition in 1947 led to the greatest refugee crisis that has ever happened on planet Earth. And I think 12 to 15 million people displaced, with Hindus and Sikhs forced to flee Pakistan for India and Muslims fleeing India for what became Pakistan and Bangladesh. So we were working on reconnecting families that had been displaced in this divide. And it was during a conversation with someone from Northeast India on the border of what's now Myanmar that I said, kind of, I was asking about how partition affected the area. And they responded, which partition? We had three. And that got me thinking because as it quickly became evident, the Raj, British India, is actually very different from the Indian nation state that we see today. We often conflate the two. But the colony that was British India has since collapsed into 12 separate nation states that exist in the modern day. And so these include modern Yemen, Oman, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Bhutan, and Myanmar. Each of these states carries some aspect of the legacy of the British Raj in ways that are often forgotten. And so these five partitions that I trace from about the 1920s to the 1970s, five partitions over five decades, it begins with the first partition, which is the separation of Burma from India. This will lead to, amongst many mass refugee crises, also the demonization of the Rohingya people, which we just see culminated a few years ago with the Rohingya genocide. That is a direct legacy of this first partition. Around the same time, in 1937, you get a second partition cutting off the Arab states. Until 1937, the city of Aden, in what's now southwestern Yemen, was actually the westernmost city of British India. And anyone living there carried an Indian passport. There's actually a, if you can see here, this is the passport of a Yemeni Jewish woman who's trying to migrate to Jerusalem after the Balfour Declaration. By virtue of being born in Yemen, she has to go on an Indian passport. So that's the third partition is the partition of India and Pakistan in 47. The fourth is the integration of these 565 princely states in a process that would create about 85% of the modern border of India and Pakistan. And then the fifth is Bangladesh's independence from Pakistan and the creation of essentially the 12th nation state to emerge from what was once one Indian empire. So this is the map. Hopefully you can see it here, how this one mega colony. So pink represents direct British rule and yellow represents the princely states, these 565 semi-independent kingdoms that would be later integrated. So this is the map that this turns into over the course of five decades.
Wow. Thank you. That's a good rundown through the five partitions. Each of them have its own stories and, you know, legacies. But the first partition about Burma is really interesting because you tell us about Burma was one of the richest regions and actually it fueled the future partitions. Can you tell us a bit more about the importance of that first division?
Sure. So in the 1920s, Burma is the richest and the largest province of British India. And it's as a result of the sheer number of people seeking new lives in Burma. It's a kind of, Rangoon is the New York of its day. So I think in 1933, the immigration officials say until recently, New York was the greatest immigration port in the world. Today it is Rangoon. We've forgotten Rangoon's central place in the 20th century economy thanks to, you know, 70 years of military rule and Burma being taken out of the world economic system to some extent and kind of going into an isolationist period of its history ever since the 1960s. But it really was the epicenter of the British Empire's economy. But the sheer number of people migrating there created all these debates about, which feel very reminiscent to Brexit in some sense, where society is divided down in the middle. Half the people are saying, immigration has made us a much more diverse and global place and the economy is thriving as a result. The other half are saying, you know, we're being pushed out by rising house prices. You know, there was an increasing sense that the indigenous Burmese people couldn't get jobs in the capital. This backlash begins to happen against migration, where people begin to campaign not for Burmese independence from Britain, but to create a new British colony called Burma. And it will eventually be created on April Fool's Day, 1937, particularly in the wake of the Great Depression. What happened was the entire Burmese economy was run by loans from the Tamil Chettiar community, from what's now southern India. If you've ever been to Chettinad, you'll have know that there's huge numbers of amazing mansions there built from Burmese teak, each one of these logs being transported by sea over the Bay of Bengal. These houses were made because this community financed the entire agricultural economy of Burma. But when the Great Depression happens, suddenly no one can pay back their debts, and so they begin seizing land. And I think in the course of just 6 years, one quarter of Burma's agricultural land falls into the hand of the Chettiar community. And very quickly, it goes from these debates that began with, you know, can we ever, as Burmese people, really feel Indian, suddenly change into debates over, well, we need to force them out. And interestingly, the targeting of Indian communities in Burma lead to direct anxieties that will lead to the later partitions. We often forget that the first ever pamphlet to mention the word Pakistan and propose the creation of a Muslim state for a homeland for Indian Muslims justifies its creation on the basis that if the Burmese could get a separate homeland, we don't understand why the Muslims of India are to be forced into an Indian union. And the founder of Pakistan, Jinnah, will later explicitly basically say that it's because of the pogroms that are happening against Indians, but specifically Muslims in Burma, such as the Rohingya, that he begins to move towards, you know, wanting legal protections for India's Muslims and ultimately creating a whole new nation state.
Yeah, so it's like we've can only really understand the later partitions unless we understand how the earlier ones and
I think impact. Each affects the next like a series of dominoes.
Yeah.
And by looking at them in isolation, we often miss the fuller context. Each partition that, you know, went in 1971 when Bangladesh is fighting for its independence from Pakistan, so many people describe the refugee upheaval as, you know, like partition, like 1947, and each of them reference the previous events to some extent.
And I was also curious about, I mean, this is a history that, to be honest, I did not know about at all before reading your book. I had no idea that the Indian Empire expanded that widely from Yemen to Burma. And yeah, it's interesting because, like, you know, the way we look at it is that, you know, Dubai could have been part of India,
you know?
And if you could tell us a little bit about that, you know, like how did the separation of the Arab nation or the Arab parts fall away? And was that before the discovery of oil?
Yeah, I think this is the bit of the book that has definitely generated the most press and that I think people are most surprised by. Mm. You go to a lot of the GCC Gulf states today, and they very much talk about, you know, this kind of primeval past where everyone was riding around, you know, catching things with eagles on their arms, and life remained more or less unchanged until oil suddenly changed everything. And in fact, there is a huge, rich history of the Gulf that has often been forgotten because all of the archives are actually sitting in Bombay. You can't actually find most of the archives on pre-oil Qatar or Dubai, etc., in the Gulf. They're sitting in Bombay.
Wow.
That's because they were run as part of Bombay province. Yeah. What happens is that I think it's Lord Curzon, the viceroy at the turn of the 20th century, who began to integrate these Gulf states into the Raj. He thought that in order to protect India, they all needed to be under kind of one administrative system. It means that they were under the Raj for the least amount of time, and that by and large, very few people in the Gulf ever really felt that Indian. The exception, interestingly, is the city of Aden, where as late as the 1930s, you did have a whole generation of Arab scholars essentially saying, you know, can Arabs become an Indian ethnicity, and is there a world in which we have a future place in a kind of, you know, an Indian nation to some extent? But the same moment that Burma's being separated off, there are all these proposals for what the Indian nation that's going to get independent from Britain might look like. One of the most popular ideas that Gandhi is certainly in favour of is that this nation should be based on the geography of the Indian epic, the Mahabharata. Bharatvarsh is this sacred Hindu holy land that is mentioned in Sanskrit texts back 1200 BC at least. And he proposes that should be the basis for the geographical contours of a new nation. Now, the thing is, of course, Bharatvarsh had never really been unified as one thing before. And, you know, in British Indian history, it had never existed as separate from the Arabian states until this point. So in 1937, you begin to get debates about whether the Arab states should be separated off as well. And what's remarkable is that the Brits essentially want to hand over this area to India and find it to be, you know, their reason for existing in the Gulf at all is to guard the sea route to India. But I think it's the British legation in Tehran who writes that it was with surprising unanimity that government of India officials told us that they had absolutely no interest in running the Persian Gulf states after we were gone. Oil has yet to be discovered, and the Indian government sees potentially having to look after these essentially villages on the other side of the Arabian Sea as potentially going to be a waste of the exchequer. And so Little do they know, of course, that oil will be discovered within the decade and that very soon, you know, Abu Dhabi will have a higher GDP per capita bar none within about 2 decades of that decision. And so it's a complete game changer. But there is this extraordinary world in which there could have been a future where they were united, whether that would necessarily have been a good thing or whether it would have led to some sort of continued colonial arrangement where, you know, for Gulf Arabs, British rule was replaced by Indian rule. Who knows? Certainly most of the kind of Emiratis that I've spoken to since the Gulf, or people from the Gulf in general who I've spoken to have very much said, you know, we can't imagine a world in which this would have been anything other than a horrible colonial arrangement where our oil would have been taken from us and led to all sorts of wars. But that was, in the 1920s, that was a possibility and one that we forget far too often in these kind of, you know, histories of the Gulf that begin from oil and look at nothing before that.
And what's interesting is that you were saying, like, this history has been hidden from, like, official maps and official documents. So, I mean, like I said, this is the first time I've come across it. So you've really uncovered something new. Can you tell us a bit about, like, why was it hidden? What was the motivation behind sort of trying to...
Sure. I think this is basically the... When the Brits first take over the Gulf, they don't show them on maps, with a few exceptions, because they don't want to piss off the Ottomans, basically. The Ottomans claim the entire region. It's kind of contested the British being there at all. And so they don't put it on maps. It's on all the internal official documents, but not in the public-facing stuff. And then later, when the Ottomans collapse, Saudi Arabia, it's unclear how far inland these Gulf states' territories go and how far out Saudi Arabia goes. In some extent, to an important degree, though, that I think, again, we often overlook, Ibn Saud in the 1920s goes and unifies the tribes of Arabia and creates the modern state of Saudi Arabia. The only reason that he doesn't extend this state into Dubai, Kuwait, Qatar, etc., is because it's under the protection of the Indian army at the time. And I think that that is far too overlooked. But yes, so they were kept off maps. And crucially also, I think that the entire generation of post-independence scholars working out of the Gulf, until recently, it wasn't clear where its archives were. And it took this guy, James Onley, he was put in charge of what was known as the Qatar Digital Library. And it was basically funded by the rulers of Qatar to figure out where any documents in any archives across the world that might reference the history of Qatar. And then they could digitize it and it could be available for Qatari scholars. And he went around the world looking for these documents and eventually stumbles onto the fact that there are entire, you know, reams of Qatar's history sitting in the Bombay archives, and that it was judged by British colonial authorities as a province of Bombay for about 70 years. And again, this is something that had been largely forgotten. But I think it's a fascinating example of how new scholarship, new archival work can completely reshape our understanding of history. The fact that, and we were chatting about this before, that there's so much that's just been declassified in the last few years, particularly from the 1970s and 1960s, and it's completely reshaping what we thought we knew about these histories. So often we pick up a school textbook and think, kind of, you know, this is fact. And of course, these things are constantly being affected by new discoveries that scholars are finding in the archives, new bits of information that we didn't previously or weren't previously aware of, essentially.
Yeah, thank you. And that was a really fascinating conversation we had just before, because as a researcher, you know, obviously I loved the incredible amount of research that went into this, but I didn't know about, as a historian, how you do your research and that, you know, documents are declassified after a certain length of time. What is that length of time?
It changes in every country. So I think in most countries, it's somewhere around, it tends to be around 50 years, okay. But it can be as little as 30. And sometimes there are things that remain mysteriously kind of classified because it will lead to some sort of national security issue. Most notably, the letters exchanged between India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, and Edwina Mountbatten, the wife of the last Viceroy, remain under lock and key. That, you know, we can't possibly imagine why this might be, but it still remains legally off limits, despite the fact that we know that they're sitting in Southampton University. We know where they all are, but they have been judged to potentially be a big enough national security threat either for India or for Pakistan or for Britain itself. Yeah. It's unclear why we're not told this.
I mean, I just love that as a researcher. And what it says about truth, history, facts, you know, it's always changing with evidence and when things are declassified. So whatever we know now, it could shift again. So it's an interesting...
I think there's also something about oral histories. So many of the, particularly with 1947 partition and the events beforehand, I think we're living through the last few years where people who remember the world wars and subsequently, you know, the division of India and Pakistan are still around. And once the last memories have been recorded and the last people have passed away, it will only be based off what we've managed to collect in these times. Already, for example, you know, most Holocaust testimonies that are going to be collected now probably have been collected. And, you know, people who lived through the events of 1944 are by and large on their way out now. They're either too old to remember them, they've got dementia or something, or were too young at the time. And there is a very few number of people who still can tell us their stories. And I think now partition, which is, you know, 3 years later, we're now beginning to see the same thing where that generation's beginning to get harder to reach. And, you know, 71, we've still got time. But I, in the course of this book, only managed to chat to three survivors of the 1937 partition. Whereas, you know, for 1947, I managed to chat to about kind of 75 to 100 survivors, and then Bangladesh even more, because they're, you know, it's that process hasn't started yet. But the way that soon that number of stories that will ever be collected will have been collected.
And you can find some of those stories in Sam Dalrymple's book, Shattered Lands, Five Partitions and the Making of Modern Asia, which is what he's talking about today on ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. G'day, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thrilled to be bringing you this fascinating conversation from the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival in Bali, Indonesia. And Sam is talking with poet, writer and researcher Husnara Khanum.
So I wanted to move on to talking about maps and borders. So we often think about them as fixed and natural in a way, but, you know, your book illustrates that these are created politically and often sometimes very haphazardly, you know. So could you tell us a bit more about how these borders were created or drawn and how the map of Asia maybe could have looked very different?
Well, I think the basic thing is that in each case, one of the reasons that I think I start the book where I do in the 1920s is it's the last moment that things could have looked completely different. There is a whole group of people who are arguing that the entire region from Aden to Rangoon could become one post-colonial nation. There is a whole other group of people who are arguing that actually the British Empire as a whole should remain structurally there, but that we should basically do, I think, what the Edict of 212 in the Roman Empire, which made suddenly people in Roman Syria have equal rights to those in Roman Italy. And, you know, same with Algeria and Roman Britain. They were arguing that everyone, you know, all citizenship should become equal and someone in Bengal could become prime minister in Downing Street. That obviously didn't happen. But the 20s is a fascinating period because none of the countries that we subsequently see were even, you know, foreseen. So I think that there is more talk in the 1920s about the creation of a future South Indian Dravidian state than there is about the creation of a country that might be called Bangladesh, for example. These states were often created in very different ways, but often very haphazardly. So 1947, I think it's June 1947, that Lord Mountbatten, the viceroy, is sent out to India to basically kind of dissolve the Raj and grant independence. He's given by Prime Minister Clement Attlee a year and a half to do it, basically. But he speeds it up to 77 days. And he decides he's going to partition India, but he's going to do so in 77 days. And this leads to one of the craziest bureaucratic nightmares ever conceived by Kafka, where, for example, once the dust settles, it becomes clear that in the division of the libraries, all the dictionaries from A to K had gone to India, and all the kind of J to Z had ended up in Pakistan. So rushed had it been. I think particularly abhorrent was the fate of the Mohenjo-Daro necklace, which was the great masterpiece from the Indus Valley civilization. This golden thread with all these beads from stones that weren't found in South Asia. They had kind of, you know, jade from China and lapis from Afghanistan and topaz from Egypt. And in a sense, represented in stone, in art, the ancient trade of the subcontinent. Now, unsure of who should get the necklace, the bureaucrats decide to snip the 4,500-year-old necklace and give an equal number of beads to India and an equal number to Pakistan, so that today you can go to the museums in both Karachi and Delhi and you can see a pile of beads sitting there with no sign telling you that they were once part of one of the great pieces of art from the ancient world. And it's in this haphazardness that you begin to see the largest forced migration in human history. So I think it's representative of a process that's repeated. But I think what people forget is, you know, the name Pakistan, the idea of this nation state, came less than 15 years before its creation. We often, I think each, nation states often project these ideas back. And of course, there have been many ideas about a Muslim homeland, etc., throughout history. But so many of these were created through contingency and through chance. And in few cases in world history, have the results been bloodier?
And then on the maps and borders, I think you had a picture as well, didn't you?
So we grow up with this idea that you can see the Great Wall of China from space, and actually you can't. And even if you were to squint your eyes from the International Space Station, you wouldn't be able to see a thing. And the only wall visible from space is now the India-Pakistan border because of how highly militarized and fenced that wall now is. You can see it from the International Space Station without squinting your eyes. It's very obvious. And so I think on the bottom left-hand corner is Karachi on one side of the border, now Pakistan, and on the right-hand side of that line is the cities of Bikaner and Jaisalmer in what's now India. And of course, you can see how close they all are to each other.
And it's quite sad in a way that you can see this from space. You know, you can see natural borders and this man-made creation to divide.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the India-Bangladesh border isn't as highly militarized, but it's actually the longest wall in the world by meters because it snakes its way so haphazardly through the Bengal Delta. It's actually got more meters of wall than any other wall in world history. And the India-Myanmar border is actually the largest border currently being built, despite the fact that, you know, we hear far more about the US-Mexico border and that construction. India-Myanmar is a far larger border project currently underway.
Wow. And just one more question about the borders. So I know a lot of us know that, like, Cyril Radcliffe did draw some of the lines, and he had never been, right, to India before he was tasked with this exercise.
East of Paris.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. And then the other borders were done with the decisions of some princes, right? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So growing up in Delhi, you talk about the India-Pakistan border as being the result of this guy, Cyril Radcliffe. Mm-hmm. Cyril Radcliffe is this British kind of bureaucrat who was charged with drawing the border. He was given 77 days to do it. He'd never been east of Paris and was chosen for the job because this was seen as his potential as an unbiased arbitrator between the Indian and Pakistani sides. So because of the fact that he'd never been, he wouldn't have a preference prior to having gone. Of course, it would lead to a very bloody result. Bizarrely, later, he would be responsible for restructuring the British Film Institute in South Bank, London. So that was his job after the creation of Pakistan, which is a rather bizarre one. But yes, one of the weirder discoveries of the book is that actually he was tasked with dividing British India, the pink bit of that map. And he wasn't responsible for any of the yellow sections of that map, the princely states. And about 80% of the modern border is actually the result of the decisions of these Indian aristocrats in choosing whether to merge their kingdoms with India or Pakistan, or in some cases, Myanmar. 20 of the princely states would join Burma. And this is a whole separate process whereby, you know, many Hindu ones joined India, many Muslim ones joined Pakistan, but far more states than I think we tend to realize kind of flip-flopped about which country they wanted to join. If you've ever been to the blue city of Jodhpur, that was a princely state. Anywhere with a Maharaja or a Nawab or a Sultan or a Sheikh was a princely state. And Jodhpur was in communications with Pakistan to join Pakistan for months. And several of the states that later joined Pakistan had communicated with India about joining India. There are so many conflicts that have emerged as a result, notably Kashmir, which was a princely state with a Hindu ruler, but a Muslim majority population. The ruler would later join India, but a lot of his population had been fighting to join Pakistan. And the two armies are very gradually brought into war over the future of this princely state. Another one is Balochistan in southwestern Pakistan, which also continues to see violence and a movement for independence from Pakistan. The origin of that secessionist ideas is that Balochistan, or Khalat as it was known, was a constitutional monarchy. And so when this question, do we join Pakistan, India, or become independent, is put to them, they put it to Parliament and they all agree we're going to remain independent. But later the Khan is pressured into joining to Pakistan anyway under duress. And the question becomes, should the ruler have made that decision or should it have been the Parliament? And, you know, who gets to make these rules, because the Brits have kind of left in a hurry and not really defined the rules of play to some extent. So I think, you know, there are several of these conflicts that we don't have time to get into now, but so many of the conflict regions, Manipur in northeastern India, same thing, result from the scale of rush that everyone was in. No one had time to answer the basic questions. And in places like Hyderabad state, where the Indian army basically eventually just goes in and annexes the place, there are three times more refugees generated in the conflict over Hyderabad state than are generated in the Palestinian Nakba the same year. So it's enormous scales of suffering that we're talking about, and yet so often are just kind of lumped into the rest of the story and brushed over as kind of footnotes in history. But this is really important and central stuff. You know, these are some of the central stories of the 20th century, I think.
Yeah, no, completely. And it's still, we're seeing the ramifications now. So there's different ways of looking at this story of partition. There's obviously the political angle, the religious angle. But your book made me think about personalities, egos, rivalries, relationships of some very, very powerful men, Jinnah, Nehru, Mountbatten, and how their sort of relationships determined and their actions determined history. So I'd just like to know, how much do you think their personalities and relationships shaped the decisions that were made? And what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's huge. And I think that, you know, one likes to write histories that aren't the kind of big man histories of the, you know, early 20th and late 19th century, which focus on a few characters. But in this case, in the story of these borders, they really are the story of a few group of men. And again, they are all men, and women are kept out of the decision-making processes time and time again throughout this story. I think what's extraordinary is how many of them come from exactly the same social class and how interrelated they all are. So at the same time that Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, his best friend is a woman called Sarojini Naidu. Her daughter seems to have been the one-time girlfriend of Jawaharlal Nehru, who's the future Prime Minister of India. And so, you know, this was an incredibly small social set to a large degree. Gandhi and Jinnah came from villages less than 100 kilometers apart. And, you know, the same specific part of Gujarat. Mm. All of the major Indian and Pakistani characters went to the bar together in London. And so, you know, they all kind of knew each other. And Mountbatten is, in some sense, the outlier here. Mm. But, of course, his personality also changes so many decisions. And I think that it really is a rather fascinating story to try and tell, because it is the story of egos as much as it's the story of grand national movements of thousands of people rising up together. I think that, you know, the story of how the British were pushed out and the collapse of the British Empire very much is a story that is, you know, the millions of people all gathering on the streets pushing, fighting against British rule. But the story of how the borders were shaped as they are is the story of a small set of men who all knew each other and all had a dramatic falling out.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many instances in the book where things could have gone very differently. Yeah. And there was one moment where there was an proposition of India becoming like the UK, right? Yeah. Like with Scotland, Wales, England combined, that kind of system. But then Jinnah wasn't very happy with that. Or
Jinnah accepts. So this is the cabinet mission plan. This is proposed in 1946 as the last ditch effort to try and get everyone to agree to a united post-colonial country. And what's extraordinary is that the founder of Pakistan, who had pegged his entire political career on creating a homeland for Indian Muslims, he accepts the idea of a UK-style system, where there would be, I think it's a North India, South India, East Pakistan, West Pakistan, and Deccan would be the five nations that constituted this single post-colonial kind of, you know, united system. And it's Gandhi and Nehru who objected to it. Okay. And it kind of slightly messes with all sorts of, I think, the general assumptions about this all being the result of kind of Muslim separatism is the very much the thing that you hear in India a lot of the time. And it's more complicated. And each of these decisions is far more nuanced and complicated thanks to a whole variety of political impetuses. But the closing doors, they close only a year before partition and independence. Yeah. I think as late as July 46, you could have seen a very different outcome.
Could we have seen a United Kingdom of the East? Imagine that. Sam Dalrymple. He's been looking at these sliding door moments of history, and I think we're living through a few of those right now, aren't we? His book, Shattered Lands, Five Partitions and the Making of Modern Asia, about the breakup of British India and all its consequences. He is the big thinker today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Sam is joining you and an audience in Bali at Ubud Writers Festival. And from the political now to the personal, asking the questions is poet, writer and researcher Husnara Khanum.
So I want to shift the conversation slightly now and just mention that I think it's really interesting that you and I are having this conversation today about partition. I am Bangladeshi, raised in the UK, and you are Scottish, British man who's raised in Delhi.
Yeah.
So we're both products of this same empire, but from different ends. So, of course, reading your book, you know, there was a lot that I could relate to, and it's opened up, of course, a lot for me. And my family have lived through all the partitions. So as I was saying to you earlier, like I was, we'd never talked about partition in our family. And I even asked my husband, and again, it's not something that it was ever discussed in our families growing up, and nor is it discussed in schools as it's not in the curriculum. But your book opened up this conversation. And I asked my mum recently, can you tell me about what happened during partition? And I said, do you remember? She's like, yeah, of course I remember. And she was just telling me how she was a teenager during the partition. And she still has nightmares about what she witnessed. She was about 15, 16 years old. She had to stop going to school because of all the violence. And one thing that really still gives me shivers is that she describes that they would wake up in the mornings and sometimes they would find dead bodies of women who had been raped and murdered and just lying there. And that still frightens her to this day, that memory. And I had not known about this until about a couple of weeks ago, you know? Mm. And these stories that I never heard and... So I'm learning a lot through your book about the violence and everything and other stories that I could relate to. So, and I'm interested in this idea of like shifting nationalities and what it does to sort of our sense of belonging. So there was a story in your book about someone having five nationalities in like 50 years. And it reminded me of my dad. He was born in 1939 under British India. And then he becomes Pakistani, Bangladeshi, then British. So four nationalities in 50 years. So, yeah, it just made me think about, like, what is that doing to our sense of belonging? And the next, it's not really a question, but it's more just to get your thoughts on this idea of these shifting identities, which we, you know, place a lot of our energy into and which has been the fuel behind so much division. So, yeah, just what are your thoughts on this?
I think that we so often... take the nation state as the kind of fundamental unit of how the world is organized, that we forget that kind of, you know, a good third of countries around today are actually around the same age as the internet, you know, particularly with the collapse of the Soviet Union, etc., is roughly contemporary with the emergence of the internet. These things shift so much. And I think particularly at a time when so much, we're seeing the return, in a sense, of nationalist rhetoric and a move away from the globalization that I think has at least kind of, you know, been the case for so much of my childhood, that I think that it's never been more important to remember how fluid these categories really are. I mean, particularly, for example, you know, you look at Britain right now, where I think there's a particularly rise in anti-immigration rhetoric and a lot of people yearning for some kind of imagined pure British moment of Anglo-Saxon, pure white kind of World War II era thing. And of course, we forget that the first known governor of Scotland from the Roman Empire kind of time was from modern day Algeria and was ruling Britain, this Algerian guy, about 1,000 years before the first Anglo-Saxons began showing up on small boats across the across the sea. And I think that we forget the fluidity of these categories, how much they've changed over time, and how, despite these nationalist narratives being so seductive, I mean, one of the extraordinary things in researching the book is how many stories like your family's there are, how many people have gone through changing identities, how many of the people who later fought for the creation of Bangladesh had earlier been fervent Pakistani nationalists. And it was only after a series of kind of political betrayals that the movement to found Bangladesh instead began. How many of the founders of Yemeni nationalism had once been fervent Indian nationalists fighting alongside Gandhi, and, you know, one particular Yemeni nationalist being a travel buddy of the great Dalit political leader Ambedkar. And so, you know, these... It's incredible. I think that the 1920s in particular is so fascinating because none of the categories that we're used to really exist at the time. It's impossible to talk about, you know, people in being Pakistani or Bangladeshi or Burma. You know, none of the categories were there at the time.
Yeah. I just find it really fascinating because, like you say, there is a nationalist movement, and especially in the UK, we can really see it happening. So it's very important to talk about that. The next thing I wanted to talk about, what really struck me and horrified me, was the level of violence that took place during the partitions, particularly during 1947 and 1971. I mean, oh gosh, I've got some stats here. It was something like 1 to 3 million people died during the partition. 75,000 women were abducted and subjected to sexual violence in the first few months. There were forced conversions. There were stories of people women who would go into wells to avoid being raped. And just the level of horror of that, the communities where, you know, people were living, you know, with different faiths side by side, to just outright mass murder. How does that happen?
It's one of the great questions. One of the things that I think is important in understanding it is that very often these massacres, I think, although that there's this image in the public that it's neighbours turning on neighbours, very rarely did I actually find evidence of that ever happening. And far more often it was these kind of private militia groups often doing land grabs and that kind of thing, seeing an opportunity to do land seizures. And one of the things that surprised me to a great degree was how many neighbours were looking out for each other. And the vast majority of the stories, of course, there are all sorts of stories that I collected that were of horrors. The vast majority were about people from rival communities looking after one another and saving each other's lives. My co-founder at Project Dastan, Sparsh, his family came from what's now Pakistan, migrate to India in 1947. And his family were Hindu, but they were only alive today because their Muslim neighbor basically hid them in his barn, sat on the roof with a gun and said, you know, no mob can come in here whilst I'm here. And then this guy, Sher Khan, manages to get him across to the border. And one of the more heartfelt things I've ever done was Sparsh, after working with him on Project Dastan for 5 years, he managed to get a visa to Pakistan and we went back and found the village. And when we went to, we asked, you know, there's this guy called Sher Khan we're looking for because he saved my grandfather kind of thing. And the guy said to us, you know, he's my father and this is the house that your family would have stayed in. And then, of course, this guy introduces us to the whole village. Until the dying day of Sparsh's grandfather, they remained in contact again after 75 years on WhatsApp, sending each other kind of daily messages and that kind of thing. And so I think that there is so much horror. And it is one of those horrific moments like the Holocaust or like the Rwandan genocide. It's one of those central moments of the 20th century which challenges so often our belief in the kind of power of humanity. And yet, actually what I've come away with researching is this, in this, is amidst the violence, the sheer daily appearance of humanity and of kind of, you know, people saving each other, people looking after each other, caring for each other, the resilience shown is, I think, one of the key messages that I've taken away from it, the project.
And I think that comes across very much in your book. Thank you. And in terms of the stories, I mean, what my mum also told me was that the village that she grew up in Sylhet in Bangladesh, there's quite a few Hindu families and they're still around today. And she was telling me that they also sheltered a lot of their Hindu neighbors. And that was really beautiful to see that amongst all the horrific things that were happening. A couple of things on that sort of violence and horror. So at the time when this was happening, there was still quite a lot of British troops, right? Still in India, but they didn't really intervene. Like, can you tell us a bit more about that?
So all of this is happening as British troops are being sent back to Britain. But Nehru and Jinnah both agree that, are both convinced that the violence will stop as soon as Britain finally leaves, because they had basically been arguing for months that all of this is to do with people protesting about the creation of nations. And as soon as we actually get there, as so, you know, the more that British troops appear in the streets, the more the people are going to go protest, the more that could lead to violence. So the Brits send back everyone with the exception of a small group called the Punjab Boundary Force. The future military ruler of Pakistan, Ayub Khan, is one of these the members of this. And I found, in researching the book, I found that my godmother's father, an Irish woman called Bridget Keenan, her father James, had been part of this boundary force. And he always writes about how ironic it was that, kind of, you know, despite being an Irish Catholic whose country has been colonized for the Brits here, that they were out in India servicing the empire nonetheless. He writes about this extraordinary series of letters down to the Nilgiri Hills about the fact that, you know, they had 30,000 people or something in a province of tens of millions, and that he'd been expecting, when he got sent out from kind of South India, he'd been expecting to find a bunch of kind of, you know, local guys rioting with sticks. Again, one of the images that I don't think is there enough. One of the reasons why specifically Punjab, the region that's now kind of northwestern India and northeastern Pakistan, the reason that that was the most violent is that's where most of the army had come from. And so these were, a lot of the massacres were done by basically groups who'd got hold of weapons after the Second World War, often had fought in the trenches or fought on the Burma front, etc., and had Gatling guns and stuff. And so this wasn't just kind of guys going around stabbing each other. This was a whole different scale. But so that, yet there is very much, and the crucial thing is that the Indian army is also unable to step in because it is itself being partitioned at the same time. I think there's one extraordinary memoir of one of the Pakistani generals, I think it was, who said that once he realized that he was being sent over to Rawalpindi, what's now Pakistan, from Delhi, he says, "We had more of a fight getting to our new posting than we had getting through Germany." He'd just come from World War II, and it took longer, and he lost more men getting through the Punjab, which was then just, So I think the kind of military aspect of all of this is very much overlooked. But at precisely the same time, British troops are being sent onto ships at Colaba in Bombay, and they're all being told, basically, because the empire has been wrapped up. I think there were plans at some point that maybe this could all happen a year later. And for a series of reasons, again, to do with these four men, that idea is basically turned away. No, we want the British troops to lead now. They I think Nehru and Jinnah also fear that by allowing British troops to remain and quell the partition violence, that they'd be leading the door open to the kind of British Empire continuing in a kind of proxy way. And the Brits would later be able to justify staying on in some sense. And that independence would not mean independence.
That's a good point. And I was just wondering about World War II then, and what role do you think that played, like seeing the violence and everything happen in that? Do you think that influenced, maybe just heightened the fear, really, and contributed to the violence?
I think absolutely. I don't think anything would have gone the way that it did without World War II. Firstly, the rushed British process of leaving is so much to do with Britain being broke at the end of World War II. London's been blitzed, Coventry's been flattened by bombs, and the Brits just don't have the money to run the empire anymore. At the same time, you've had millions of Indians go out and fight and learn to use guns. And I think we forget that the Indian Army, you know, we often talk about the British fighting in World War II. It was the British Empire, and the Indian Army in World War II was the largest volunteer army in world history. Enormous. So I think so much of the politics is intertwined with the story of World War II. And I think it's a similar story, I think, here in Indonesia, where the arrival of the Japanese, the sweeping through the region, the collapse of European authority with the arrival of Japan in the Eastern Front changed the entire process of decolonization and sped it up by some decades, I'd say.
So what so many things I love about this book and reading it and what it's done for myself and my family. So I've got two young kids, got a 5-year-old and an 11-year-old. And what I love is that it started to open up these conversations in our home and with our children. Yeah. And that's something, like I said, I never got to talk to my parents about. So my question is, when thinking about future generations, what role do you hope your book will play in helping people understand their past and future?
That's a big one. I think that, I mean, if people left with one idea, so often now, and I grew up with this in Delhi, this kind of insistent demonization of the other sides, and the extraordinary fact that so many of these conflicts are so recent and could have gone so very differently. You know, recently Trump was talking about India and Pakistan have been fighting over Kashmir for thousands of years. And of course, there's a whole generation still alive who remember a time before these two countries were separate and before the fighting over Kashmir had ever begun. I think that the essential goodness of people and the kind of common source of all things, of course, you know, it wouldn't have necessarily been a good thing had the Raj remained intact, but, you know, with the British gone. And I know there would have been all sorts of, particularly the Gulf, for example, that was far less populated, would have seen a very different history. But I do think that some of these shared histories are something that the fact that everyone's experienced the same horrors to some extent, and trying to move past the kind of demonization of the others and understanding the shared traumas and is the only way that we can ever move past it.
Thank you for that, Sam. So I think that's the end of my questions.
Thank you.
That was wonderful.
History, it certainly explains a lot, doesn't it, about the here and now and how quickly we forget it too, perhaps to our fault. But historian, filmmaker and writer Sam Dalrymple is helping to remind us with his book Shattered Lands, Five Partitions and the Making of Modern Asia. And this conversation, which we've been bringing you today on Big Ideas, came from Ubud Writers Festival in Indonesia. Big thanks to its wonderful team. And the host was poet, writer and researcher Husnara Khanum. Project Dastan continues its work, recording the stories of those whose lives were uprooted by the 1947 partition of India. You can watch them online, in fact, and we'll link to that site in our show notes for this episode. And if you like what you heard today, let us know. bigideas@abc.net.au. That's bigideas@abc.net.au is our email address. We love hearing from you. Until next time, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Big thanks for your company today. Back next time for more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.